All right, today is, what is today? August 17th, 2011. This is the first interview with Heather Daniels. We're here in 334 Bascom on the campus of UW-Madison, and I'm Troy Reeves, the head of the oral history program for UW-Madison. So Heather, thanks for reserving this room for us today. And I also want to say that this interview has, we have two reasons to talk with Heather. First is about her time on campus as a graduate student and with academic staff, and then we also want to talk about the events that occurred in February and March earlier this year, the protests at the Capitol. So the first question has nothing to do with any of that. It's the obligatory sort of brief biographical question. So if you don't mind telling us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, parents, occupation of parents, things like that, just to kind of bring us up to the time that you came here to UW-Madison.
Sure. So I grew up in Wanakee, Wisconsin, which is just north of Madison. I think we moved there when I was about four and went to the Wanakee School District there. I have one younger sister who's about 5 years younger than I am. And my mom has worked at American Family Insurance for probably 30 years. And growing up, she worked kind of the evening shifts so she could be home with us during the day. And then my father was a graduate student here at Madison. That's actually why they moved to Wisconsin, but never finished. He realized nobody in his department actually graduated, so he ended up quitting. And served as a college instructor in various places, Ripon College, Edgewood. And then found his niche in doing development work for nonprofit arts places, and currently is the director at the Monroe Arts Center in Monroe, Wisconsin.
Okay.
I went to college at a small liberal arts school in Iowa called Coe College. I'd gone to band camp at Luther College for a number of years when I was in high school, and was really attracted to that experience. And Iowa has a lot of private colleges compared to Wisconsin, I would say. So concentrated my search in Iowa and found a good match at Coe in the city of Cedar Rapids.
And is that COE?
Yep.
Okay.
COE. And in college, majored in biology and general science, and was very active in the music program there, both in the jazz band and the concert band.
So that must have been an interest you had growing up, music?
Yeah. I've played the clarinet for, gosh, probably 25 years. And picked up the saxophone in college because they were going on a tour to New Orleans, and I wanted to go with the jazz band, so picked up the saxophone in college.
Do you still play either of those?
Both of them.
Both
yeah.
of them.
Yeah. My husband and I both play the same instruments, and we play at the Edgewood has kind of a community concert band with also some of their students, because they don't have a student organization or an ensemble right now, that plays during the academic year. And I also occasionally play with the Wanakee band in the summer, the community band in Wanakee, which is still directed by my former middle school band director. And then we go on tour every couple of years with the co-college bands abroad, usually.
Is your husband went to school at Coe College too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, we met there.
All right, so biology in college, playing in the band, and then.
And then I went to grad school at Boston University. And I was actually in the marine biology program, so we were located on Woods Hole. And I got engaged while I was in grad school there, and my husband was finishing up his last undergraduate year at Coe. And so I finished a master's degree in biology there, and then we didn't really have jobs or any place to go, so we We decided it was either my parents' house or his, and we decided we wanted Madison over Bloomington Normal, Illinois. So moved back here and got a job with the university.
Okay. Was it just difficult to get a job in biology, marine biology in the mid-90s?
I think it's a difficult way to make a living unless you go for your PhD. And I also have, the main reason I have asthma and allergies, and I need to have health insurance, so.
Okay.
You know, working for a nonprofit and not having health insurance just wasn't going to cut it. It's something I'd absolutely love to go watch whales whenever I can, and would love to do that when I retire, actually. We'll see.
Okay, I think that's, we do have one more interview scheduled, so there may be some of this I want to follow up
sure.
on, but I think for today we might as well just sort of keep plowing through chronologically. So you moved back here sometime in 96?
Yep.
Okay. And according to your resume, let's see. Okay, so soon after that you get a job on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that first job?
Sure. I was I didn't know what this was, but I was at LTE, basically, for Paul Sundell, over in the pediatric oncology part of the hospital. And it was a great first experience. It was a wonderful to read mail that he had gotten from patients who had survived, you know, whatever leukemia or whatever they had when they were little. And it was also, he's a very organized man, so it didn't take a lot of time on my part to organize him. He also has a research lab, so to be an MD, PhD at that level, you have to be, hopefully, you either have to be a really good organizer or somebody, you have to have somebody that you really trust to organize you. But I only worked there for a couple of months.
Yeah, it says, basically the summer of 96,
yep.
And then
yeah.
you get a job at the Center for Neuroscience. So
mm-hmm.
How did you find out about that?
In the newspaper. Yeah, it was one of those rare. I applied to an ad in the newspaper and got the job. It was at the same level that I had been at LTE at, but it was a project position, which I also didn't understand at the time what that meant. But basically, they're positions that usually you're just trying out to see if they're going to work or not, and so there's a limited amount of time that that position can actually exist. And the Center for Neuroscience was established as a organization to kind of bring together neuroscientists on campus. There was no Department of Neuroscience on campus. So you had neuroscientists scattered throughout lots of different departments. It also intertwined with the neuroscience training program, which is the PhD program in neuroscience on campus, which had been around since 71. And at the time when I took the job, the primary administrator for the PhD program was out a lot because her daughter was very ill. And I believe you've actually seen Paul Sundell, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up doing a lot of her job as well as mine, just to fill in, as it turned out.
Now, so this is very early on in your time here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, within basically, it looks like 3 months, you've done two different jobs.
Yep.
And it sounds like from what you're saying is that you came in with little or no understanding of sort of the internal campus.
No clue. And in fact, you know, I went to, you know, Boston University was big, but I was never on campus. So I was in a small little cadre of, you know, probably 30 grad students. McCall College has about 1,200 grad students. So the shock of being with so many people and also realizing, especially in the neuroscience program, that there were a lot of professors here who cared about their students, despite what I had always imagined or heard about big universities being kind of, you know, you never knew your professor, you only knew the TA and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't necessarily always true.
So in these, and we'll say early years, because it looks like this job at the center was basically 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look for, or did people help mentor you in sort of learning the how to navigate through this large university?
Yeah, so Ron Khalil, who was the chair of the neuroscience program as well as the director of the center, was my boss for that time. Hooked me up with Lynn McDonald, who's still the administrator for what was then anatomy is now cell and regenerative biology. I don't remember what that new department, it's one of the new med school departments that she's the administrator of. And those first few weeks when I started working for the center, she was key. I mean, we had all these new grad students coming in, they needed to be paid a stipend, so there was HR paperwork to put through, and so she walked me through how to do that and was always available for questions and very patient and willing to help out. She's absolutely wonderful and key. I mean, without her, I'm sure no students would have gotten paid because there's no good manual on how to do things often. And my predecessor who had been there had left maybe even a couple months before I came. So there are some student workers there who were still there in the office who showed me some other things as well, but they never got into that kind of nitty-gritty kind of thing. So
where were you located when you were working for the Center for Neuroscience?
In the Medical Sciences Center. The old state hospital.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was a typical day? What were sort of the things you would do when you were working there?
I wouldn't say it was necessarily a typical day. Things seemed to be more happen more, you know, maybe once or twice a year. There were a lot of special projects we did, newsletters. And again, at that time, especially probably that first year with Eileen being gone so much from the PhD program, I ended up doing a lot of that kind of thing, which kind of melded the center and the training program together in my job. Just because I was filling in because she wasn't able to be around. So I was dealing with a lot of students, a lot of special projects. I mean, the center wasn't part of a larger department or anything, so anything, payroll, fixing computers, you name it, you kind of had to do it.
Do you think having to do myriad things prepared you for either your current job or other jobs that you've had?
I think it's been helpful. I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about that because at the same time I've wondered if being kind of a generalist or jack of all trades has also kind of pigeonholed me at a certain level because I'm not a specialist. You know, up until recently, probably haven't been a specialist in any one area. And so I think often at those higher level jobs, they're looking for somebody who's really specialized in X, Y. And because of the previous nature of my jobs, I haven't been able to do that. But at the same time, I find that having knowledge of all those systems really informs decisions I make at my current job, for sure. I know purchasing rules and I know HR stuff, and so that's all important with research administration. So really, it does help a lot, and I think people don't necessarily realize that. And I didn't either until I started doing it, and I said, oh, it's really helpful that I know how to do this or look up that, because I need to do that for this job. It makes me better at what I do.
But it does sound like it's there's two sides to the sword.
I think so. I do.
Since this was a project position, were you encouraged or did you seek out opportunities to become involved on campus in other ways?
I wouldn't say on campus at all, no. And really those first couple of years were just trying to hang on and get stuff done.
Now, since I don't think you can separate sort of your life from your life,
mm-hmm.
So at this point, you said you moved to your parents' house. Did you, once these jobs started to come available, did you try to find living somewhere else?
Yeah, we moved out in August, so basically at the end of my stint with Paul Sundell. To an apartment on Gilman Street. It's probably all the longer we could have stood, you know, either side. It's a difficult situation living with your parents when you're an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And especially bringing somebody else into that household as well. It was difficult, but it worked out okay.
Did your husband had just gotten his degree?
Right.
By that time?
He had just gotten his degree. He ended up getting a temporary job at, what is it called? Scientific Protein Labs? In Wanakee. Probably about the same time that I started with, maybe a couple weeks earlier than the job that I started with Paul Sundell.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you said that he matriculated here to graduate school. Was that around?
He didn't.
Okay, he didn't come here.
No.
Okay.
My father and his...
Oh, sorry. Great. Yes, thank you. Okay, so this project position looks like a two-year position. Did you know it was ending with enough time to be able to put out feelers elsewhere?
I knew it was going to end, so I definitely did apply for other jobs. And Eileen left right about that time, and her job had been a half-time position with the training program. And Ron Khalil came out to the grad school and asked for a 100% time position to run the graduate program, basically. And so I applied for that position, and likely because I had been doing a lot of the work just because Eileen had been gone, was able to take over that new position.
And is that, was that an academic staff position?
Correct. Okay. So that's when I became academic staff.
And did you know what academic staff was?
No. I had no idea.
So, I mean, there's a much longer, I mean, you worked at it for 10 years, so there's a much longer chunk here on your resume as Assistant Director of Graduate Studies and Administrator for Center of Neuroscience.
Right.
So, do you remember initially where the learning curve was?
I would say I overcame part of that when I was with the center again because of Eileen being gone. And I guess what I did, since I'd had basically 2 years to work into it a little bit but also observe, is I started looking at our procedures and policies, especially as they related to students, and realized that what we had written in the handbook didn't always match what we actually did. So I started to make changes in that way. remember that being one of the early kind of projects that I worked on. You know, if we aren't doing X, Y, and Z, then maybe we should take that out, or maybe we should do that. We need to decide, but our policy should match our actual what we do in practice.
Now, is that something that you saw and asked to take on, or was that something that
basically, yeah. Okay. I would say it was really with a full-time person for the neuroscience program that program really started to expand with the number of students we had. Neuroscience faculty seemed to be coming to campus all the time, and so the faculty really started expanding too, and I think the two of that, them together, plus the full-time administrator really allowed that program to start to really blossom and become a bigger player on campus as far as the biological sciences and grad students.
I think you've talked about this a little bit, but maybe we could go into a bit more depth about what it meant. What does this neuroscience training program mean? What did you do, particularly now that you're that's your full-time job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. You know, it was a great time in my life, I would say. I really enjoyed the people I worked with. The faculty were wonderful, and I absolutely enjoyed the students. Especially at that time, when I started that job, I felt that I was about their age, so I could really relate to where they were and where they were going. Whereas when I had first started, I remember thinking, wow, they're going to grad school and they feel a lot older than I am, even though most of them probably weren't. But we definitely had people who were married or had a kid, you know, not a lot of them, but they felt older to me. And by the time I took that job on permanently, it felt more like they were my peers, I guess. Mm-hmm. I would say that job gave me, I remember becoming much more confident in my abilities and judgments to make decisions, which is something you don't really do until after you leave college. I mean, you make little decisions, but not decisions that affect people's lives so much as they might in this situation. The program also had a pretty large outreach component that I expanded while I was there to teach people about the brain and the importance of making sure you wear a helmet and keep your brain safe, and that was a lot of fun to do, to go out to schools, and we ended up developing a relationship with the Madison Children's Museum to go there once a year, the first Sunday in April, Brain Day out there. It was a lot of fun. It was also a lot of work. I probably never worked harder in my life. I remember when I first came up here 3 years ago, realizing that people did not work here till 6 o'clock at night, and I was like, this is different.
So even though you were, assistant director of graduate studies, you were still in the med science?
Yep.
So the old hospital?
Yep. You know, Ron Khalil was still the chair for probably another 5-6 years. After I started that job full time. And he was very, he very much wanted me to stay after that project position ended and thought I had great potential and was a great champion of mine in those really early years, which was wonderful to have. And I think that no doubt helped with my confidence and my ability to do stuff. And then there was a, there, the neuroscience community on this campus has a long history of not getting along with one another. There's always kind of been, at that time there was even the neurophysiology department in the med school, which doesn't exist anymore either. It merged into physiology at one point. And there's always been that camp, and then there was kind of the people who were friends with Ron camp. Is the best way I can describe it. And while all these people were members of this training program, there was often disagreements, more private disagreements, I think, than too public disagreements. And prior to the time I had come to the neuroscience program, there had been a big fight to establish a department of neuroscience. The two sides really couldn't agree on what that department would look like, who would be in it. And so that had fallen apart. So after I'd been there 5 or 6 years, tempers flared again, I would say. And there was a move by the medical school to replace Ron with somebody else. And so there was an election that was held for the chair, and somebody else won. And that was probably that whole thing was one of the lowest experiences I had there. I remember several times going to the bathroom in tears because I got along with Camp A and Camp B, and I felt like I was caught in the middle, being the administrator of the grad program, you know, very much appreciating Ron for what he had done for me. He's a very quirky man, and I understand the other side too a little bit. So, and I didn't feel, you know, I wasn't going to choose a side, and yet at times I felt like they wanted me to, I guess. So that was a difficult period. The new chair who was elected was Ann Kelly from psychiatry. And we moved, we had been in Ron's lab space, the program had been, and so we also moved out of that space at that time too, when Ann got elected.
So did you stay in med science, just a different?
Yeah, just a different floor. We moved up to the floor where they seemed to put emeritus professors. But it was easier to get to, the directions were easier than the old office, so it wasn't all bad.
Did you take that initially as a, how did you take that initially when you move up to an area that basically has all the retirees?
You know, I thought there were pluses and minuses too. We definitely had more room, which is great. And I thought it would be easier for students to find, which I also thought was good. I think in the end it was okay.
So, you started the job in 98. Let's see here, you got your degree, your library school degree in 2003.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. So I wonder if we could sort of...
Sure.
It's not off topic by any means because, you know, you were here when you got it.
Yes.
But I'm just interested in how that all came about, and then talk a little bit. I'll ask you some questions about the program itself.
Sure. So, you know, I was working for the program, and I thought things were going well, but I didn't know where I would go after that. And so somewhere along the way, so when did I graduate from?
It says 2003, December.
Okay, so probably around 2000. And I know it was still when Ron was chair. I decided to apply to library school. I'd worked at the library at Coe College for the library director there. And again, had been a great champion of mine, and had very much enjoyed that experience and working for him. And we're still very good friends today. He just retired a year ago. So that was a little bittersweet. So I thought, well, maybe library school, because I really like libraries. I love books. I like the idea of organizing information. And so I applied to this list here and got in. And so I started going to school part-time.
And by part-time, what are we?
So I initially thought I would try to do two classes in the fall, and one in the spring and one in the summer. The spring for graduate programs, as you can imagine, is pretty busy with admissions. And in the biological sciences, we actually fly in applicants to visit the program and spend a weekend. So it's a pretty, there were weeks where I would work, 80 hours. If you counted, entertaining the students as 80 hours, which I did. And so I thought I could probably handle two in the fall. The first year, though, I decided I should probably play it easy and just take one course. I also didn't want to be in school forever, and I figured doing that would get me out at a relatively fast rate. I figured I could finish in 3 years. I actually finished in 3 years in one semester, so it wasn't horrible. And I got some credits for the coursework I had done in my biology master's, so that also helped speed things up.
So some of the questions I normally ask when we talk about just graduate school here in general are professors and classes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you would be willing to talk about, let's start with classes that you felt
I really liked.
Yeah, and if you want to do the other side of that, you can too. But obviously, it's your interview. You can talk about whatever you want.
I would say there were two professors, and the classes they taught were equally good. And those was Ed Cortez, who isn't here anymore. He moved to some other university. I think he might have become dean somewhere, but he had been here a long time, and he was also my advisor. He's kind of specialized in science and technology, libraries, that side of things. And then Kristen Eschenfelder, who's still here, and she was a brand new assistant professor after I'd been there like a year and a half or 2 years. So she just came in towards the end of my career. And she's very interested in freedom of information, the digital divide, that kind of stuff. And so those are the kind of interesting classes, the didactic cataloging or organizing information classes. I would say weren't very challenging, and so did not hold my attention as much as some of the electives. I took one from Kristen on copyrights, which I find copyrights, patents, that kind of stuff extremely interesting for whatever reason. And so that was a lot of fun to take that from her. Ed Cortez taught a class on indexing, which I took, which is actually kind of interesting. And my husband actually, for his job right now, puts together a big book every year of current trends in the deli, dairy, bakery part of the supermarket, in that industry. And that book has index, so I've actually helped him improve his indexing. Because there are some rules of the game that indexing programs don't pay attention to usually.
Mm-hmm.
If you take an indexing course and actually index by hand, it's kind of fascinating, really. He also taught a course on special libraries, which are, not public libraries, not K-12 libraries. They're libraries typically within some kind of either organization of some kind. So we went on a bunch of field trips, and that was really fun. We actually went to Chicago, visited the Tribune Library, and the library at the Art Institute, which is very cool. like the Crane Foundation has a library. That was one of our field trips. And we went to American Girl. They have a library there as well. So that was very neat to see all those different libraries and get more of a sense as to how libraries play a role in hidden ways that we don't usually see.
So as you were advancing in this class or in the program and gaining a degree, were you interested in trying to then move out of what you were doing and move into something else?
That was the thought, absolutely. I started volunteering at the Ulbrich Library because they have a little library at Ulbrich Gardens. And because I knew I wasn't going to be able to work, I didn't want to quit my job and work at a library part-time because there's no way I was going to make enough money to live the way we were living. And I'd also promised my husband that I would not take on any debt for this degree. So I started volunteering there to get some experience. They were doing a trial of kind of live chat with librarians that now I know is very common for UW-Madison libraries at WNT, the engineering library. And so I volunteered and did that for a little while, helping them with that trial. I indexed a book that one of the other professors was publishing for library school. So I tried to kind of gather bits and pieces of experience so that when I went on the job market after I finished my degree, it wouldn't look like somebody who just had a degree and no experience because I've been working full-time doing something else.
All right, but obviously, by looking at your resume... You stayed as Assistant Director of Graduate Studies.
I did.
So
I did apply for a couple jobs on campus, and by that time I kind of figured out the personnel system, and I also figured out how to look up what people made. And I realized by the time I graduated, in order to go into the libraries, I would have taken a pay cut. I did get at least one interview on campus for a library position, but it wasn't in the cards.
So was it you wanted to stay on campus?
I think by that time, yeah, absolutely. You know, we had bought a house, so I didn't really necessarily want to move. Alan really liked Madison. I really like Madison. So moving out of the city wasn't attractive to us. I knew from looking at job ads that Madison pays its librarians pretty poorly because we have a lot of them here. And I knew I could make, you know, not take a pay cut by going to a different university somewhere else. But we really felt at home here and didn't want to leave.
Were there any other, either classmates or professors or classes or anything about the SLIS degree experience that stands out in your mind that you would like to get on the record?
You know, it was interesting because there were a bunch of part-time people in SLIS, and I don't know how many there still are, whether they've kind of changed their focus, but in Wisconsin, in order to be a K-12 librarian, you have to have a teaching certification and a master's degree in library science. So there were a bunch of K-12 teachers that either were librarians and basically had been exempted while they went to school to get the degree, or wanted to become librarians because there seemed to not be enough supply for the demand at that time, who were going to SLIS part-time. And so I kind of found myself with them quite a bit because we were going at about the same pace. There were also a small number of other part-timers who seemed to work on campus, either as doing classified library positions or something else. And So there was a small little population that I hung out with during that time, which is great. Although even then, I still always felt it's weird to go to school in a graduate program part-time, I guess, is what it comes down to. You just aren't, no matter how hard you try, you're never going to be as integrated or as involved as if you're there every day, most of the day. In fact, after the first year, they decided to change the curriculum and not offer some of the classes that I would have had to take as a requirement to fulfill the degree. So that, I think it was the first summer then, a group of part-time SLIS people took, basically we self-taught ourselves one of the classes that they were discontinuing as an independent study to fulfill that goal. And I guess, you know, that kind of thing is what leads you to feel that you're really not a part of it, because they clearly didn't think about any of the part-time students, and they have a pretty large number of them when they did that. And it was interesting too, having been working for a graduate program at the same time I'm in graduate school, because students would have issues about registration or credits or whatever, and I always knew how to get stuff done because that's what I did for a job. So that was kind of interesting. Because I remember in graduate school the first time, I don't know, they just told us what to sign up for, and I signed up for it. I had no idea how things worked at all. Whereas this time I knew backwards and forwards how things worked.
Was there, I guess I'll ask it this way, how would you describe your relationship with the students who weren't part-time then, the students who were coming in to get their degree?
Yeah. For whatever reason, and it was usually because I would never have more than one class with them. We never, you know, I knew some of them, I knew their names, but because we didn't have that multiple opportunities to see one another, those are not the people I developed relationships with. It was the people who were doing the classes at about the same pace that I was, that I would run into them. You know, we'd have two or three classes together. Whereas the regular students, you know, you'd see them once maybe in one of your classes, that was it.
So how do you feel, it's an odd question, probably as a part-time student who then, you know, stayed in your profession, so to speak, how do you feel the degree, or do you feel the degree bettered you?
I think it did. And I didn't really realize that until I was out a couple of years, that I realized that it was much more efficient at finding information. And I could think of, I was pretty good at figuring out keywords to use when to search for something. I got very proficient. And it's not that that's what you do in the classroom in library school, you know, but clearly all the classes I had taken together had led me down that path, and I'm not quite sure how. You know, I don't remember ever taking a class and saying, okay, if you want to find out this answer, what keywords might you use to search? You know, there was never any exercise like that. But I think the idea of learning how information might be organized and cataloging, all of that uses kind of keywords. And so learning about that, I think you just, it's one of the byproducts, not necessarily and I'm sure it's one of the stated goals as well of some of those classes, but it's not that you're doing exercises specifically about that. It's the best way I could put it.
Okay, so now we're going to go back to I feel like Monty Python are going to something completely different. but what I want to ask now is, so in 98, when you get this job, you become academic staff.
Mm-hmm.
I asked earlier about mentors, mm-hmm. you know, into your job, but what about mentors into what it is or what it means to be academic staff?
So that kind of occurred when I was asked by Beth Holden, who's the grad coordinator for the biotech training program on campus, if I would be interested in running as secretary for the Madison Academic Staff Association. I guess at that point I kind of knew that I was academic staff, but I still didn't really know what that meant. Like, I knew it meant I'd be salaried, because I used to be hourly, and I knew that it meant I had to have a bachelor's degree. But anything about governance or what that group really means, no idea. So she asked me, and I said okay, and I ran and was elected as secretary of the Madison Economic Staff Association. That was kind of the tipping point. And there were a bunch of people at that time, Ann Wallace and Shar Todorisi and Bill Stoffenhagen, who had been here and been through the creation of governance for academic staff. And it was really listening to them and hearing what was going on currently that I began to learn a little bit about what it meant to be academic staff on this campus.
All right. So what does it mean to be academic staff on this campus?
Good question. Well, it may change slightly, but I think it means different things for different people. I would say when the unit clarification letters came out a couple years ago, and that was the effort by classified unions to get academic staff positions changed to classified positions in their unions, basically. People would write to me and say, you know, I don't want to be in a union. I want to be able to come to work when I need to work and leave and not have to punch a time clock and not have to account for every minute of my day. And people were also very concerned. One of the unions that had petitioned for some positions did not have any professional staff in their union. So a lot of people were concerned about losing what it means to be a professional or have professional status in their job. And I think the academic staff as a whole is just beginning to realize again, especially as we're able to transform our personnel system, that academic staff on this campus means that we get to participate in the decision-making process of what goes on. And more importantly, we get to control the policies and procedures regarding academic staff and employment of academic staff.
So, there's a lot there. But I want to, and we'll probably come to that in our follow-up interview. I want to, do you remember the year that you ran and won, or roughly when you ran and won?
Is it in here? I think it might be in there.
It should be. It's an important thing, so. Secretary from 2000 to 2007.
There you go.
Wow. You were almost secretary for life.
For a while. And I stayed on because, you know, we have an academic staff assembly and you have a rep. And it was maybe a year into being MASA secretary that I realized there was an assembly and I should have a representative who should be communicating with me. And I didn't have one who communicated at all, ever. So MASA was the one way at that point that I got information as to what was happening on campus in governance. And after I learned that, you know, I had a rep who wasn't communicating with me, he ended up leaving the district that I was in shortly after, you know, maybe a year after I made that discovery. And so I ran for the district and got the district then as being the representative for the assembly.
Okay. So maybe this is a good time to talk about academic staff assembly.
Sure.
So the first thing is, I think I know, but who knows who will listen to this, the difference between Academic Staff Assembly and Madison Academic Staff Association.
Sure. So the Madison Academic Staff Association, or MASA, was formed prior to us getting governance rights. They're basically the group that got academic staff governance. The way I've heard it told since I wasn't here at that time was, after merger, things finally settled down. The university started reforming committees that had existed prior, and academic staff started realizing they weren't included in those committees because students and faculty have been included in the state statutes as having governance rights, but not academic staff. And that started a movement of going to the Capitol and talking to legislators ad nauseum about getting academic staff governance rights so we could be included in the decision making of the university as we had been prior. And so 1985, I believe, was the year that finally passed. And once that passed, then a group of folks, mainly those original people who helped get it passed in the first place, sat down, formed a structure, started writing our academic staff policies and procedures. And so the Academic Staff Assembly is the governance body for the academic staff. MASA still exists, as you know, today. And there have been calls occasionally about whether it should still exist. Is there a purpose for it? You know, the purpose of it, at least at the moment, is to provide information to academic staff and offer a place for academic staff to come together and meet one another. But we've also felt through the years that it's important to have a body or an organization that isn't so closely tied to the university that it's constricted by university rules and regulations, say perhaps in regard to political activities would be one instance. And so that's why MASA, I think, has remained around, even though it's played a less activist role since that initial creation of governance.
So what is the structure of the Academic Staff Assembly? I mean, you said you ran for representative. I see you're here, you know, as a representative from 2002 to 2007. So what is the structure of Academic Staff Assembly?
So it's arranged by districts. I think there are 109 districts total. And there's a districting and representation committee that assigns people into districts, partly based on what their title is, and partly based on where they're located. It's not nearly as clear cut as it is for faculty, where they're arranged by whatever their tenure home department is. We felt those two things tend to bring like interests together. So what you do at your job and where your job is located, what school or college, or even we have districts that may cover you know, one or two departments or centers.
So these 109 districts aren't necessary. I guess what I'll ask is, are you saying that these 109 districts are designed to try to bring disparate people into a district, or are they designed to try to bring similar academic staff type folks?
People who might share similar interests.
Okay.
Anybody who's been on campus for a while begins to learn that, you know, teaching folks seem to have some issues that they don't share with research folks or administrative folks, and vice versa, you know, across all three. Likewise, the culture in the School of Medicine and Public Health is certainly quite different from the culture in LNS, so you wouldn't want to bring teaching folks from med school and teaching folks from LNS together, because their culture, and while they may share some of these teaching issues, culturally and their school location, they're going to face other different issues between the two bodies.
Okay. So as a academic staff representative, what were the things that you did? What were the major things?
Sure. So you are expected to attend the meetings, which occur once a month during the academic year, and then at those meetings, you're eligible to vote on any kind of resolution that comes up or changes to the academic staff policies and procedures. And in addition to that, you're expected to communicate with your district about what's going on, share minutes or agendas for meetings. So it's not a huge workload, but it's an important one.
So you were there, you were in that position, it looks like, for 5-6 years, depending on how you slice the years there.
Mm-hmm.
Were there key events in those years that you recall?
Oh, gosh. You know, like anything, I would say the early years, I just was trying to get a feel for what happened, how it happened. I do remember one debate we had about extending the amount of time you had to give notice for somebody who would be not renewed because of funding loss. And of course that affects research folks. And so there was some disagreement between some people who were administrators for primary research units, who I think we went from maybe 3 to 6 months, something like that. And they felt, you know, at a 3 month time, I will know whether that grant's gonna be renewed or not. So it'll be less likely that I'd have to give somebody a non-renewal letter. At 6 months, we may have heard from NIH or we may not have heard from NIH. And so we aren't really gonna know, so I'm gonna end up giving a lot more non-renewal letters to folks. In the end, I think it was, in the end, we voted to lengthen the times for everyone. But that was an interesting, disagreement or discussion.
It sounds like during this time, both as MASA secretary and an academic staff assembly representative, you also were a mentor, academic staff mentor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have been a couple times.
If you talk about the, since this is your, you know, story, your why you decided to become a mentor and how that experience has been for you.
I guess I decided to because I thought it would be a nice thing to do, and I had had a, you know, I mentioned Lynn earlier on, you know, I'd had basically had a mentor who was academic staff who helped me when I was first getting started. Not necessarily about academic staff stuff, but about my job. And knowing how big this campus is and how easy it is to feel disconnected and lost and not knowing where to go when you need something, I thought it would be a good thing to do. I think it's a good program. I've only done it twice, and I have to say, the best success with the matches that were made for me. But in the end, I think actually my last pairing worked out really well. She was a research specialist who ended up then going to med school. So she didn't stick around, but she'd come to me with issues or problems she was having, and we'd work on solutions for them. Usually did it over lunch. And so I really did enjoy that one, and kind of watching her grow and change and get really excited about being able to go to med school. And then I think she ended up, then she was playing around with the possibility of doing the PhD, and of course I had had a lot of experience with talking with students about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really enjoyable match. We've kind of, one of the problems I always felt was that the matches were made in the spring, and then most people, I think, started in the summer if they were around in the summer, but the program didn't officially start till the fall. And so with the first one, we started meeting in the summer, and that was okay, and then the fall came around, and we just got both really busy. And so we, one of the things I've worked with the mentoring committee on as Chair of ASEC was trying to readjust that calendar so that at the time the matches are made, that's when you start. So we've changed that so the matches have been made now and there'll be a kickoff in October after the craziness dies down from the beginning of the fall.
Mm.
And I don't know if that's, I mean, we've only done it, this is the second year, so I don't know if that's worked better for people, but that was certainly one idea I had as part of the mentoring program to change that time cycle, basically.
All right. And we're at an hour, which is usually a good time for my brain to start the shut off. No offense to you.
No
it's
problem.
Just the way it works when I'm trying to do this. And it also seems that there are some switches that happen around 2007 to the present.
True.
That it might be nice to start with those. And my guess is it might be because of what you're doing there that led you to become involved in February and March
mm-hmm.
of this year. So
yeah.
I think that might be a nice way to sort of break this.
Sounds good.
So I will say we do try to leave the narrator with the last word. Anything on your mind about what we've talked about or anything on your mind about your experience here on campus that you might be afraid if you don't get it
mm-hmm.
off your chest and onto the record now, we might forget it for the follow-up interview.
I'd say nothing too specific. It's just I haven't kind of told anybody the story, I guess, before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting to me in the way the pieces came together. I can totally see where I got to be an ASEC chair from way back when I started as MASA secretary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember being in the assembly, and ASEC always sits in the front of the room, and thinking that I'd really thought I'd be interested in that someday. But I honestly didn't think it would be, you know, less than 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just interesting to reflect on that.
Well, we will we'll do some more reflection on that then. When we meet again, I know we have a second meeting already set up.
Mm-hmm.
So until then, thank you very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.